Before we begin, I just want to mention a grief workshop that's happening really soon. On Sunday, February the 22nd, I'll be in Waterford at the Haven Hotel, which is right by the sea, and we still have a few places left. These days are really special for anybody who's grieving. They're open to everyone, and most people actually come on their own. And what people often say they value the most is the sense of community, just being in a room with others who get it, who understand without even having to explain. We'll spend the day together with real life stories, panel conversations, guided gentle meditations, reflective journaling, and space to just be. Lunch, tea, coffee, they're all included, and the setting itself is beautiful and calming. If this feels like something you might need right now, you're so welcome to join us. Tickets are available now on griefireland.com. Okay, hi everyone. I'm back again this week and I am joined by the lovely Evan Daly. Hi, Evan.
How are you, Cathy?
I'm not too bad. And you?
Not a bother.
We've half a podcast done ourselves.
Oh, it's the intro when you, how are you? And we're after talking for 10 minutes.
It's really good to have you here. You actually record your own podcast in this studio. So we've crossed each other here one day. I think I was coming out full of tears and you were waiting to come in. So
exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
And then I saw you online. And you know what? Most people I have on this podcast, they reach out to me. I kind of like it that way because I want to know that they want to do it. But the odd time when I see someone online that's kind of publicly speaking themselves about grief, and I saw that you were. So I was like, do you know what now? I'm going to reach out. And so here you are. So thank you for coming in. I'm really delighted that you agreed to sit down with me today.
No, 100%. Thanks very much. I like talking about it as well. You know what I mean? I think it's one way of coping too, like, you know, telling your stories and share. I think it's good. I think it's good and important that obviously it's not for everyone, but I think it definitely helps me that little bit. And I'm speaking about it on a regular, well, not on a regular basis, but every now and again, yeah. You know?
You're open to it.
Open to it for sure. Because, yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Okay. So, what we will do is go back a little bit. I always like to hear about your person. So I suppose you've lost your dad, Iggy. So can you tell me what life was like growing up and tell me about your dad and all of that?
Yeah. So we had an incredible childhood, and you honestly couldn't have asked for a better childhood, to be honest with you. And there is myself, Darren, and then obviously Mam. And I suppose throughout my whole childhood, it very much revolved around horse racing. And that would probably be my biggest memory. And it's the one thing that's nearly always top of mind because it was such a huge period of my life that was connected to dad, you know, where I'd say me and dad spoke nothing for 10 years on horses, to be honest with you. You know, it was just every single day we were just with the horses. We were I obviously had started my racing career when I grew up into my like teenage years. So firstly, we started when we were like pony racing, so this is kind of the period where a jockey is trying to make a little bit of a name for himself before they can go to the whole professional scene. And dad used to be with me every day, bringing me to the gallops, loading up the horses multiple evenings. He'd come home from work. He'd align his whole days nearly to be home in time before it gets dark. We'd bring the horse to exercise them and train them, head off pony racing every single Sunday.
You had your own horses?
We had our own horses, yeah. We had bought two or three. We'd probably, I suppose, three or four throughout the years, and bought a couple from England, and had good luck and good times throughout that them pony racing days. And it was all to build towards, I suppose, my career of being a jockey when I was 16. But every single weekend on a Sunday, as I said, we'd be going up and down the country. Wouldn't matter where it is, we were going pony racing. It was all the meeting on. But then on a Saturday, when I was, say, 13, 14, dad would be bringing me up to the likes of Meads, up to a big trainer of Gordon Elliott, Ger Lines. He'd wait in the car for 6 hours while I was riding out, or else he might do a couple of sales jobs himself up the country. And yeah, throughout them years, life just revolved around horses, and it was everything for him, to be honest, you know.
So is that his interest, or had he a background in it himself?
No, he had no background in it. Dad owned a pub in Athenry called Iggy's Bar, and it used to be a really, really good pub. But throughout that time, he was involved in a syndicate. So obviously, like, you know, when you're in the pub game, bit of horse racing, be a bit of crack, and a few of them got involved in the horse. But that was really the extent of it, to be honest. And he obviously had a bit of interest in racing, but was never hands on. Like, you know, he wouldn't be able to put a bridle on a horse or anything. Like, do you know what I mean?
He never left up himself.
No. And it was only when I was probably 8 years of age, I just got this notion where I used to get pony racing or horse riding lessons off of a spot in Claregall with their O'Brien's Equestrian Centre. And he would just go with me of like a Thursday evening, and I'd actually get guitar lessons before that, and then we'd go up there, and the guitar fairly got the bin fairly soon. But I got the bug, and he saw, I think, how obsessed that I got with it. And it started off with your hunting, a little bit of show jumping, and then as you hit 12, you almost become and almost a young adult in a way in the racing game. You have to grow up very, very fast. And he recognized that, and he recognized that was the only thing that I was ever going to be doing, you know, which obviously I thought didn't work out that exact way. But he was just so hands-on with it all. And like, it just didn't matter. It just didn't matter what you'd ask from him. He would just always help and always put everything aside to just what needs to be done. You know, it was so hands-on, and there was never a question. If I needed help in anything at all, he was just the first man, always, without a doubt. It was unbelievable, like, when you think back to it.
And what was his character like? Like, was he quiet, or was he full of crack, or what was he like?
He wasn't quiet. No, Dad, the way I'd probably describe Dad was, he was probably the most bubbliest, generous, kind, and full of life. Like, the way I describe him is we were obviously, you'd have the chats when obviously he passed or whatever. Sorry, Jesus Christ, we're gone already.
That's okay. We'd have chats. You wouldn't be the first.
But we were chatting around that time, and we used to be saying it was nearly annoyingly in good form. If you get me. That was him. He was just on cloud nine as soon as he woke up every morning. It's like, just tone it down a notch. You'd be almost thinking to yourself.
Wow.
But it was in obviously a really good way. He was just so full of energy all the time, like, to be honest, you know. And I just don't know how, but he was just always full of life. He'd be up at 4 or 5 in the mornings, heading off fitting rubber, and he'd be ringing people on the way, and you're like, these people are in bed, you know. But he was just in his own little bubble,
and
as soon as Iggy's up, everyone's up, like, you know. That was kind of the way that he was.
And you said fitting rubber, what did he do?
So he was in the pub game earlier years, and he sold the pub, and then he went to work for a company called Easy Fix.
Oh yeah.
So Easy Fix are a rubber products company, so like agricultural and equine. So it's slatted sheds, rubber mats for slatted sheds, cubicles, and then they have the hurdles on the racetrack. So Dad was a salesman in the agricultural side of things, and loved his job, like, absolutely lived for his job.
There was a bit of the equestrian there as well, so he absolutely loved that, I'm sure.
Exactly, yeah. And he actually wasn't really involved in necessarily the equine side of it, but it's all the one in a way as well, you know. Mm. But he lived for his job. And around that time when he passed, he used to be on about, he used to be just thinking back and just saying, I just absolutely love my job. I don't know what I've ever retired. You know, that's almost the way he used to speak about it, because it was in a sales role, be speaking to farmers every day, talking plenty of shite, and you know what I mean? And the way that I think the reason that he was so good at his job is because I never knew, you know, the way obviously in a world of sales, you hear people on about little tactics around selling or whatever, where I used to be with Dad in the van all the time, and I never even knew selling was necessarily a skill, because all I heard was just him having conversations with people and telling stories and going on absolute rambles. And I used to be sitting there, it's like, well, you're going so off topic here, like, for the job that needs to be done, you know. But it was just the trust that he built with people, and obviously, yeah, all the people just really liked him. He was just a very liked man, you know, and that's the long and short of it.
People buy from people.
Exactly.
And, you know, it doesn't matter what you're selling, really. But if you trust in someone, believe in someone, and that's obviously what he had. He had that, like, I'm not here to harm you.
Yeah. And that was it. It was trust, obviously, good products. And then he was just a case that he was able to build relationships with people, and none of it was
Great
in any way transactional or anything like that. I still get to this day like messages from randomly enough farmers on TikTok and saying, Jesus, I met Iggy once. And like these people would have only met him once or twice in a lot of these messages. And he stuck with us. He was a very trustworthy man. And it was all that sort of terminology that was being used. Trust, generous, funny. You know, they were always the terms that would be used, I suppose, you know.
And his family, obviously, with you and, you know, the horse racing, he sounded so committed and so, as you said, you were the priority. Same for the rest of your family, obviously. Was his family everything to him?
Yeah, everything. Yeah. So dad had, nine brothers, one sister. I think I have that right.
That's okay.
But yeah, he used to all, like they're very
huge
close,
family.
Like the whole lot of them. Yeah, they're very, very close. And they had their own, they had a tough life as well with different passes and that. His brother passed, drowned, and the son drowned with him the same day. And then, yeah, his father passed, obviously. And then, yeah, his mother passed only a year before that, actually, on nearly her 100th birthday, you know?
Wow.
But the whole family are so tight-knit, you know? You can, if you saw them all in a room together, it's very clear to see that they're brothers, like, do you know what I mean? But he was always the aegis of the lot of them in a way, do you know, that sort of way.
Oh,
but no, very much a family man, without a doubt. And I think a club man as well, you know what I mean? A parish sort of a fella, you know?
Yeah. Just side note for you, I know me and you spoke a little bit, I suppose, about then you yourself obviously entered that professional jockey world, which is, you know, we were just chatting amongst ourselves. It is crazy because weight, you have to make weight and it's so restrictive and it's, you're so prone to injuries. Obviously, you're going, someone said to me, it's one of the only sports where an ambulance follows you around, you know. But I suppose for you then, you found that world quite difficult in terms of restriction and dieting and injuries. And you made a decision then to leave that. What was your dad like around that? Was he so supportive or had you any fears of letting him down? Or what did you think around that?
I did, but completely just something that I created in my own head. So throughout my whole childhood and teenage years, racing was the only thing that I was ever going to be doing in my own head. Like there was nothing else. And I almost had a complete identity around that. People knew me for the racing is kind of what I had created in my own head. And it was the only thing I felt I was, say, good at. Do you know what I mean? And it was the only thing. There was so much time and money and effort pumped into that over the years that it wasn't something I felt I could necessarily let go of. But I had just struggled quite badly with my relationship with food and binge eating and severe restriction, and it used to just take up so much brain capacity. The food noise, the constant thinking, can I have this now, can I have that, what's the number going to be in the scale in the morning, how much weight I'm going to have to take off for tomorrow when I have to do a certain weight in Killarney, and the constant sweating and dehydration. So it was just an accumulation over time. And I used to say this to anyone, because as soon as you go, I suppose, saying that you're struggling, you're almost seen as vulnerable, or people think it's only a matter of time before you're out. Obviously, people aren't stupid. They can see that you're struggling, but you would try and hide things as much as possible. And that's where there was like the secret eating and things like that that would be happening. But my weight was going one way. But from the outside looking in, I was like a lad that wasn't eating anything. Do you know what I mean? Because I was nearly trying to hide it, but I was codding myself, if that makes sense, do you know? So I was struggling a lot. And as I said, you'd be keeping it to yourself. And from there, I did vertebrae in my back in February 2019. I got a fall in Clonmel. And I was out for 2 months, came back, second ride, broke my collarbone, and out for another 6 weeks. And then I came back and I was like, oh God, I don't know how long more I can keep doing this. So there was the guts of 5 months that were gone in the year there. And obviously I was 19 at the time. So I'm thinking, right, how sustainable is this going to be? And I was obviously off. So I was struggling quite badly. Like I had to get all that weight back down again before I go back racing, and pair that with the breaking of the bones, pair that financially then as well, because obviously you're off, you're getting a little bit of money from the Inter Jockeys fund, but it's not going to keep you afloat, like, you know. And there was one day where I just said, nah, I can't do this anymore. So I actually rang Dad, and I was putting off the call, I'd say, for a couple of weeks, to be honest with you. And he just said, well, I couldn't be happier. And he said, I can't think of the exact words that he said, but it was something along the lines of that we had a mighty time. It was the best years of our life, but you're 100% right. And he had said something to, what did he say? Jeez. When I had finished racing, he had said, fuck.
It's okay.
Jesus. He had said that it's the first time in a long time that I've had a conversation with Evan. And what he meant by that was I was probably very snappy and probably short-fused in a way. And I was just struggling, do you know what I mean? And yeah, that was when he said that day, I was like, oh Jesus Christ, that's awful, like, do you know? Don't get me wrong, that sounds like we had an incredible relationship.
Makes
but
sense.
It was I was just struggling, and I was obviously hiding so much about myself, and I was trying to portray that I was enjoying it in a way, you know, because I was trying to cod myself, you know. And sure, like, he'd bring three times a day. I'd be like, what more could you want today? Like, do you know what I mean? But just wanting a conversation. But yeah, that was when I realized, God, that last, say, 12 months, that's not good, like, do you know? But geez, no, he couldn't have been. He was just thrilled. He was thrilled once I was happy, you know, that's the way he was. And I'd created this thing in my head where he was going to be disappointed, but he was delighted.
Far
I was out
it.
Safe and sound, you know.
And that's a relief for you then, because, like, it makes sense. It's something that you've really connected with and bonded over, and you would, no matter what, and you know the type of guy he is, but you would feel like, oh, I don't want, like, to end this thing between us as well. But it never did.
Not at all. And literally made no difference what I was doing. It made no difference. Like, I went into engineering after that. I went doing personal training course after that. And then I thought that I wanted a stable job, and I wanted just no pressure, because it's constant pressure with the race. And little did I realize that I did like a little bit of something different. Like, you know, not that there's no pressure in a normal job, but I liked kind of working for myself in some way, shape or form, you know. But before I kind of realised that, I had done a year of engineering in college, and again, he was just showing the same interest, you know what I mean? It made no difference what I was doing, but sure, I was useless at engineering, and he knew I was useless, do you know what I mean? But
pack that in there, Evan.
Pack that in, it's more or less, it's like, I don't know what you ever went into that for. But again, he just trusted me, and he trusted myself, he trusted Darren in everything that we did, and he was so hands-on in anything that we wanted to do, and it was just, what can I do to help? But, you know, that's the way that he always was with everything.
Like, as a parent, I'm sitting here going, like, what a dad, like.
Unreal.
Everything you want in a parent.
Exactly.
It's just, I don't care what you do, as long as you're happy.
100%. And that was it. And there was some bizarre like, when I, it was around, what was it? 2021, January 21, I was sitting down on the couch, and I was like, I was at the time in college doing engineering, and I had said that I'm going to have to get a part-time job here while I'm in college, and like a summer job. And I just said, I'm not going into something that I don't want, that I don't get a bit of a kickoff. The only thing that I got a kickoff was, aside from racing, was nutrition and weight management and personal training. Because I educated myself over that kind of 2-year period when I finished, you know. And I just said one day that I'm going to try and open up a gym. Do you think there's any sort of a place around? And next thing, he was just ringing, driving around the place, trying to find areas. We ended up then, he was a huge help in getting a little space in UN there in Sarsfields. And we completely renovated the whole place. Like, say, the whole family helping out with the paint and the ripping the place apart, putting in all the new windows. And the whole lot. And I had done a month, and the place was going really, really well of all personal training. And I was walking out the door one day, and I don't even remember saying this, but he was saying this to me in his last kind of few days. He said that I said, you know, this isn't actually what I'm really wanting to do long term now, you know. I said that to him. So he was thinking, you're after putting all this into this place and you're telling me a month in this is what you want to do. And what I basically meant was that I wanted to move the business online eventually, do you know? So a year later I did.
He was like, oh, Jake.
Yeah, what next is this lad going to come out with? But I think just what all that summed up was he just trusted you in every decision and allowed you to make your mistakes as well. Like, do you know what I mean? And there was no pressure with school. There was no pressure with anything. It was just work hard, do what you wanted to do, and he trusted that you'd put everything
find
into
your
it.
Way.
And yeah, find your way. Yeah, find your way.
He sounds amazing. Like, as you were talking, what I was thinking, this popped into my head, I don't know why, but it's like, you know that song, The Wind Beneath My Wings? That's what he sounds like. It's like he was the wind beneath you were flying because of him. Like,
yeah, literally.
You're just getting in there. Yes, you want the gym, we'll get in there, we'll help you. Like,
yeah, and there was just, I think that's some lesson like for going forward, to be honest. It's just think about it, but trust yourself and back yourself.
Yeah.
And because he took his risks as well, like over the years with his different little pubs and things like that, you know. And I think it's probably instilled in me that if you have something in your head at all, and obviously you weigh up the pros and the cons, but don't delay and make the decision and go for it and see how it works out. You know, that's the way I try and look at things as much as possible.
So coming to, I suppose, June.
Yeah.
Your dad's a fit and healthy man.
Yeah.
No complaints.
No.
Tell me then, when did he start to make any sort of complaint, I suppose, from a health point of view?
So the start of May, he was getting a little bit of pain in his hip, maybe a little bit before that. We'll say April, get a little bit of pain in his hip, and he was getting physio for it and didn't really know what it was. Just thought it was just muscular or something like that, you know. And he went to physio one day and the physio was pressing down. And Dad said, I remember when we came home, he says, I was absolutely roaring. And the physio was like, you realize I literally just put my finger on it. Like, I didn't do anything. So got a few rounds of physio, doing his rehab at home, lying on the carpet in the second floor, the upstairs of the house. And nothing was working. And the physio then recommended that he go get an MRI. So from there, Mom and Dad went away to the Europe Hotel, actually, for a weekend away in
Kerry.
In Kerry, yeah. So that was the end of May.
Mm.
And he was in such pain down there and he couldn't sleep. And obviously it wasn't this bad leading up to it, but it was just, it got really, really bad. And he literally was in bed for, I think, a good bit of the day, the second day. And they drove home on the Sunday. They had to go to Leia Healthcare, stopped off in Leia on the way home, and he got an MRI and got the results. This is a Sunday. He got the phone call on at the Thursday, and me and Darren are in the kitchen with him, and he just says to us that got a phone call from the consultant today, and I was making a bit of toast or something, and I said, how'd it go? And myself and Darren are there, and he said, they think it's the big lad. And we said, what do you mean the big lad? Again, butter in my toast. And he says, they think it's cancer, and he just broke down. And obviously just like, oh my God. But at that stage, you're like, you never think it's going to come to your own door until it does come to your own door. That's why I always was anyway. And he just, the first thing he said was, we're keeping this to ourselves. We're leaving your mother out of it. And we're going to try and handle this ourselves for as long as possible. And
oh, bless
him. Yeah, the next day we went into our dad went to the hospital. He wanted to go in himself. And I had saw the report. He showed us the report, and obviously straight away you just throw it into ChatGPT and just say, break this down simply. And it didn't sound good at all. Like, you know, so it was a lesion on the bone,
okay,
is what it was. And that Friday when he was in there, we got the call and he just said, would you mind coming in? And sure, ma'am, again, you can't, you know, straight away, we all knew about it. So myself, Darren and ma'am went in, and I'll never forget that day sitting in the room. And he's just like a shell of a man, you know what I mean? The fear in the face is just frightening, like, to be honest, you know what I mean? And you just knew as the lady came in the door and she trying to prepare you, you can hear it coming. And she just said, don't have any travel plans for the next few months, you've a long road ahead of you. So again, at that stage, you still have a little bit of hope, but you also know that, okay, it's in the bone, like it came from somewhere. And they basically said that we're just trying to find the origin of it.
Okay.
So it was literally at that stage, we went home that evening and yeah, dad was, he was shook, obviously. We were all shook, but we were just like, we'll fucking fight this. Like, do you know what I mean? And it was the Monday he went in again. And it was just that week from Monday to Friday, it was just blow after blow after blow. And it was just all dragged out in the way that it was all being explained, I suppose, you know, in regards to it was getting worse and worse and worse. And there was more bad news after another. So it ended up he had a cancer called cholangiocarcinoma, which is a bile duct cancer. And it's the screening for it is, there is no screening for it. And it's deadly, basically. And it's only when you, like, the amount of messages I've got that my husband or my father, my mother only got X days or X weeks or whatever. And it just seems to be the same story over and over again. And it was, I think, maybe the end of that week where they basically had said to us that if you've short weeks left, they said it's all over your body. So it was in the, it's obviously bile ducts, liver, bones, muscle, and literally within a few days, like, you could see a deterioration. Now, as soon as dad heard that it's the end, basically, he was just, that's it, lads. But smile in the face, having the crack, completely and utterly accepted it. And
Really?
I don't know how, to be honest, you know. So
he was well in himself.
He was well in himself, yeah.
The only thing he had was the pain in the hip.
Only thing he had, the pain in the hip. And obviously then, like, obviously with the bilirubin number was rising with, you know, the liver, and that was going into liver failure. Obviously you could see it visually was starting to change. But in regards to his spirit and his crack that he was having, flying, absolutely flying. And just completely accepted it. And there was just so many visitors coming in. Honest to God, it was embarrassing nearly at one stage, the amount of visitors coming into him. But we were trying to slow them down. Little did we know, he was texting them in the room, telling people to come in, you know. But he just put on such a brave face throughout that time.
So the plan was no treatment. Mm-hmm. And they told him that this is just time.
Yeah. So I did a few hours. We were in there obviously every day, and this one day I knew the consultant was coming around. I thought they were coming around, say, around lunchtime, and I said I'd do a few hours in the office before I'd head in, because obviously you were there all day every day, so you just need a breather for a minute, like. And I was walking in and I saw the consultant and his colleague. I knew which ones they were, and they look like people that are after giving bad news, and you just, that feeling you get straight away. So I was walking down the corridor and I was just opened the door and I was knew what to expect. And mom and Darren were either side of dad, and they were all obviously in bits. And Darren was kind of like at the doorway or the door side of the bed, and dad just popped his head out and he just said, it's all over, Ev, he says. And it was just horrendous. It was just like, the world was just caving in, like, do you know what I mean? And it's hard to see someone like that was just fine, and you're looking at them and you're like, you're not going to be here, like, do you know what I mean? And in a few weeks, and it was just horrendous and hard to process. and wrap the head around. But equally, for them few weeks, you have conversations that you would never have. And obviously, we're not saying we're lucky, but we're grateful that we're able to get them few weeks, you know, because I know some people aren't lucky to get any time, you know. That was one thing that we were obviously grateful for. But the way that they basically explained it to us was that you could get treatment. And again, there was a little bit of mixed sort of messages coming from different people, you know, and that was hard to process. And, you know, when you're in the height of emotion and that, you know, one person said that you could, but you might get these extra couple of months, but then you have a conversation to maybe people that you really, really trust, and they know what you want, and you want a nice end to your life, you know. And all he wanted was to be pain-free throughout that period. And when the idea of treatment was coming, they basically said that, again, you could get a little bit of extra time. But then from speaking to the people that we were in contact with, it said that period of time might not be the nicest. And he was like, no, that's it. There was no chance. You know what I mean? There was absolutely no, it was everywhere. And from there, Dad came home and he just enjoyed his last week and a half in the house.
Before I go to that, do you mind if I ask? Oftentimes when people are, I suppose, given a diagnosis like that, it can be very difficult to talk about death. I know myself, my own sister was dying. We never spoke about it.
Yeah.
And I used to personally feel like, you know, I don't want her to think that I think there's no hope. So I would kind of just like not go there. And we would just talk about fantasies. You know, when I get out of here, I'm going to do A, B and C. And she wasn't going there, so I didn't go there. But I do hear people saying it makes it a lot easier for a family afterwards, because then you know what they want and this, that and the other. Was your dad able to go there with you?
Oh, 100%. Yeah. Yeah. So
when I'm not here and all that.
Yeah. We didn't necessarily have a whole pile of conversations around when he's not here. But what we did have was like, he'll be just the way that he was, and it was kind of like surface level in a way, basically that you'll be all right. Hope everything works out for you. Oh, fuck. But we wouldn't have necessarily spoke. We wouldn't have necessarily spoke about the details of when I'm not here.
Okay.
But he would have spoke about that this is the end. I'm going to be okay. I'm okay with it. And he just wanted to make sure that we were all fine. And he did that, like, do you know what I mean? And that's the only thing that he cared about.
Did that give you any comfort knowing that he was okay with it?
100%, without a doubt. Like, I think that was the most important thing. Because it was the worst time ever. Like, but seeing how happy he was, you'd nearly feel guilty for being emotional, do you know what I mean?
Really?
But like, just every single person just obviously bawling your eyes out around him, and he just sit there and he, I know, and it's just like, you know, it's just, he's the one going through it, you know, and he's the one going through it, and yet you're the one trying to hold yourself together, you know. But
it's devastating.
Yeah, he was just so strong, I think, throughout that period of time. And I was just, once he knew that it was the end, he was strong throughout it. And I remember when we were at home, he was planning his own funeral and everything, like, and we've a long driveway into the house, and he was out in the front field. And it's basically was like it's a nice kind of field. It used to be kind of like a little pitch area that we'd have. And he was walking the land to see would it be feasible for car parks. And he was hopping the fence that day, and the hospice nurse was pony pulling in for the first day, and she says, please tell me it's not you that I'm here for. He goes, well, it is a girl, Lynn. And he walked in the driveway, and that's the level that I'm talking about. Like, you know, it was bizarre, and it was very strange to experience, but again, it was nice to experience, because, you know, he everything happened the way that he wanted it to happen within the scenario, obviously, you know. But
that's unreal to think about a man, anyone, like, it's fear, you know, there's so much fear around death, to be able to go out and think about it. I wonder now, will there be able enough space to park cars here? Like, the mind boggles to think about how someone can actually face that.
Exactly. Which is, it's, I don't know, is it something that switches in your brain come the time? I don't know, is everyone like that? I'm not sure. But yeah. I obviously have never, ever experienced that before.
The courage of
it. But yeah, it was the courage. And again, he just looked back on his life and he was just so grateful for it, you know. And it was even things like, when dad he was slipping at this point, or you could see deteriorations, he was getting weaker in that, and every day come down, getting weak, all right, now today. And he'd walk down the stairs and he says to mom one day, here, will you bring me around here? I want to go around and visit a few people. This is literally within 5 days from when he passed. Like, he went around to the local shop to Frank and Mary, an elderly couple. They came out of the car. Some we went around to another 3-4 people, stopping in, like, to just say goodbye. Like, it was bizarre, absolutely bizarre. But yeah, he was Iggy until he passed. Like, do you know what I mean? So yeah, mad time. You just don't know what's around the corner, do you know? So yeah.
So you get him home, obviously, from the hospital. And what's really important to note is he got diagnosed on the 3rd of June.
Yeah.
He passes when?
3rd of July. 3rd of June to the 3rd of July. 4 weeks, literally, yeah. And obviously, when we were in that room the first ever day, you're never thinking that it's just going to be that short. You don't even think it's possible that it's going to be that short, because you're looking at a man that's fitting rubber the day before. Like, do you know what I mean? Before he was diagnosed, almost, I think, nearly, he was completely fine, you know. And you think you have a road ahead, you think that you'll at least get a few years, you know, like, that's where our brain was going. But as I said, it was just blow after blow, and unfortunately, the cancer is, it was just such an aggressive one. And yeah, he just had no chance. And obviously, when you're in the room and they're given a little, like, treatment option, as soon as, like, he realised that he was, quality life was going to be quite bad, and that realistically it was going to be the chemo that was going to take him rather than the cancer, in a way, you know, he was just like, there's no point. I want to keep my life as long as, in, you know, till the very end, you know. And again, he got to do that, you know.
How were you, I suppose, in that month? Because to watch someone deteriorate, the shock, all of that, how did you find that, I suppose? Was it really traumatic?
It was hard. It was awful, to be honest. The way I explained it, and I spoke about this before, it was a nice last 2 weeks, is the way that I explained it, but equally horrendous 4 total weeks. And I found that process, I don't know, is that grief at that stage? I'm not sure if it is or not, but when you know that they're going to be taken within a few weeks, and we wanted, like, straight answers to consultants, and, like, obviously it was he wanted complete open conversations all the time, but then you're just, it's hard to have them conversations, and he's sitting there, it's hard to ask the questions. So obviously in the hallway you'd often pop out, like, and just say, look, one day myself and Darren, what's the crack here? Like, And he just says, your father is just extremely ill. And I would say short weeks is basically what they'd said. So I think just throughout that time when you're seeing someone smiling and laughing, your brain, I don't think, can process that you're never going to see them again, like within a few weeks. And that was just horrendous. And you're just driving along the car. If you have any bit of space at all, your brain's just, for me, and I was just going back to all the memories and that, you know, before he was even gone. But then obviously you're having really good conversations, and conversations that you'd never have usually on a normal day-to-day basis in the normal day-to-day life, you know. But there were really nice conversations you'd have with them, and you got to say the exact way you felt, and he'd get to say the exact way you felt. And what was nice about it as well was you just saw how popular that he was as well, you know, like, as in, it was just floods of people coming in, and just people were just broken, like, you know what I mean? Because you'd see his friends and everyone was his best friend in a way. Do you know what I mean? That's the way that he was. So you're seeing them, they're going in and they're just coming out broken. You know what I mean? That was the real hard part. They're going in and just grown men and just coming out broken, like, and he just saying goodbye to them, and yeah, it's just awful. Yeah, it was a horrible time. But one thing that's nice about it as well, you get very close with your whole family as well. Obviously, we're a very tight-knit family as a whole, and you do definitely get you get closer. Like, there's no two ways about it, in my opinion, anyway. And that was nice. In a way, do you know?
Yeah. I mean, I didn't know Iggy, and I'm heartbroken.
Yeah.
No, just the way you're explaining it, it's like, it's so sad, because you just think, there's no time.
No.
There's no time. And actually, all that matters then, and I've said it so many times in this podcast, is like, all that actually matters in the end is kind of love, isn't it? And that's actually what his friends, like, they were so broken because they just loved him and they didn't want him to go and to have to say goodbye. And nothing else mattered.
No.
Money didn't matter. Nothing matters. That's all it comes down to in the end.
Yeah, it's crazy. Know? And I was speaking about this one day, and I did a little podcast on it myself, sitting in that chair. But I was just kind of saying, when push comes to shove, it's the only thing that actually matters. You start thinking about all the stuff that you're stressing about and that in your day-to-day life, and it just is, none of it really matters. But again, I think sometimes it's the reality of it is, say I'm 7-8 months on from it now, from when it happened, you are still stressing about the little things in life, because at the same time, everyone's stressors are relative. And I think that's important too. And sometimes it can be an oversimplification, can't it, in a way, as
yeah,
well?
Yeah, I agree, yeah.
But in the moment and that time, you're just like, what is, you know, you just work all your life. You do so much good.
You build a life.
You build a life,
and
yeah.
Then what?
And
gone.
Then just gone. It's just like,
doesn't make sense.
What is this like? Do you know what I mean? And it's, yeah, it's just hard to understand why it happens, like, isn't it? And again, it's not even, I don't even go there of wondering why him, because it's just life. Just, there's no,
it's random.
It's, yeah, it's just, and I think you can drive yourself crazy, and I think there can be a lot of nearly anger in a way as well towards it, like, but it's just, it's just the way it goes, isn't it? You just don't know, like, and it's just not fair. It's not fair, but it's just, you just could happen any of us in the morning, and that's just the reality of the situation.
Yeah, I agree with you. Yeah, I mean, I remember, you know, at the time, let's say my sister's death, like being like so frustrated by people with minuscule problems. But 100% here I am going, I'm so stressed. I have to do this, this, and this. Because you just fall back into it, like.
Yeah.
But in, I suppose, in the moment, it's everything is so irrelevant, like.
So relevant. And there was that one day where, I don't know, I was coming home from the hospital one of the evenings and I just sat in the car and I was just looking around the petrol station. I was at the petrol pump. I was looking around and people roaming around, running and racing. I was just like, this is a mad world. You've no idea what's going on in someone's life. Absolutely no idea what's going on behind closed doors. But to everyone else, life is moving on. And yeah, it's simple as that, isn't it?
I always say that. I always remember coming out of the hospital and I always found that the biggest teaching is stepping out of the hospital where you have been just devastation. And then you step out and someone's like, are you ready? Are you going in the door or what are you doing? Or like someone's beeping at you because you're a second late at the light and you're like, wow.
Yeah.
Like no one has any clue. Like no clue.
And your fuse will be well short at that stage as well. Like
seriously short, yeah.
Yeah, the hospital is it's an eye-opener, isn't it? When you're in there for 12, 13 hours a day for a couple of weeks in a row, yeah, and you're just seeing just a heartbreak everywhere.
Yeah.
It's an eye-opening place, so it is, without a shadow of a doubt. Yeah, for sure.
So your dad passes at home with you?
He did, yeah. So basically, dad is at home the whole way through. And he had no pain at all. Obviously, they were keeping on top of the medication because that was his one wish, that he wasn't going to be in pain. And it was one day he got this pain. It was just awful. It was horrendous. He was just in excruciating pain around his liver. And ended up topping up with the medication that to help manage the pain. And it was almost from there, like, where things did start to deteriorate, because obviously the body was failing, like, you know. But I remember Darren was actually playing. It was, I think, a league county final or league final for hurling. And, obviously we were with Dad. We were like, we were trying to ring hospice and just trying to manage things as best we can ourselves for until they could come out. And Dad was like in just agony in the bed. And Darren, I think, had kind of said that he's not going to the match, whatever. And Dad just turned around, you're fucking going to that match. And he could barely talk, lying in the bed with the pain that he was in. And we came home and they'd actually got a picture. They had the cup there for themselves as well. And yeah, he was just buzzing. It was that if they're after winning All Ireland, like, do you know what I mean? Which was lovely as well, like, you know. But he was until, I think it was 3 days, yeah, where he had reached a point, you know, or 2 days probably, where he reached a point where he was unconscious in a way, you know.
Yeah.
And I'll never forget, we were coming down the stairs one day and we knew he was getting weaker and we were like, we'll have to go down to the bottom room. And he was, again, 100%, he took everything to the chin. He knew this was the plan. This is what's happening. And we were helping him down. And like, obviously he's weaker, like, at this stage, you know, he's weaker at this stage. And I just said, or one of us, I think it was Darren actually, just said, one step at a time now, going down the steps here as we were helping him, like, and we obviously were being really careful. And next thing, he just starts singing, one step at a time, just singing away to himself, like. And we're like, this is just, again, mind boggling, you know. So it was from there, within a couple hours from that point, he slipped into a sleep state. And he was like that for probably 2 days, I think, from that point, 3 days maybe. But hospice were just unbelievable. Like, I know everyone says this, but the lady that we had, she was just unreal. There was a warmth to her that you can't describe, like, just so peaceful, and so, how would I say, like, you just felt so safe around them, like, you know, because obviously your only priority is him being comfortable, like, you know. Yeah, she was some woman, like, in fairness to her, is some woman. Yeah, just incredible. Like, they don't get enough credit. Like, that is how they do that job, I'll never know, you know.
It's a vocation, isn't it?
It is, yeah, it is. So Yeah, we're all with him. He took his last breath. Myself, Mam, Darren, then our two girlfriends, Clara and Sinead. And yeah, that was it then. So, mad. Mad time. Yeah. Then you have to try and organize. Oh, actually, sorry. He'd organize the whole funeral, I suppose. I was going to say, we'd try and organize funeral. He'd everything done for himself. He'd his songs picked out and everything like that, you know, which is mental.
What songs did you pick?
Actually, we picked a couple, actually, where, what was the, Simply the Best was one. Lonely Island was another one. Amble.
Wow.
I think there was one of Sean Kane, because he had his earpieces and he used to sit all day. Like, obviously, unless there was people there majority of the time, but if he was heading off to sleep, he'd throw the earpieces in and listen to Sean Kane for the
I'm no stranger to the rain, that kind of a vibe.
Yeah, exactly, that type of vibe. So, no, I was like a beautiful send off. I think we were 6-7 hours. I think we were standing up and there was people sympathizing. And I mean, it was just straight for 7 hours. People were coming in and it was just bizarre. The amount of people that he knew was just crazy. Like you're seizing up like at one stage, you know what I mean? It was incredible, but he'd be smiling if he could see the send off that he got, like, to be honest, you know. And that meant a lot to him, like, as well, you know what I mean? Like, he would have loved that, like, you know, he'd love the bit of attention in a way, do you know what I mean? In a nice way. But he got a really nice send off. And yeah, just, yeah, that was it.
To me, it sounds like, you know, the cancer was so, I've actually never heard of that cancer. And it sounds like it, absolutely, there was no stopping it, but it never took his spirit.
No.
Took maybe his body, but never broke him.
No, never did. He shook him for a day or two and that was it. Like, it was just, he accepted it.
Went out in his own terms.
Yeah, exactly. And again, it's grateful that that was the way, that was the way that, that he was. And I don't know how he did, but thankfully that's the way that he was, you know, because you could see him as the normal Iggy, like, the whole way, like, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Which was good, and it's what he wanted to.
So I suppose the aftermath of that then, you know, it's a new world really, isn't it, to be in a world of grief.
Yeah.
How was those, and you know what, it's still, you know, what did you say, 8 months?
Yeah, July, what's that? July.
It was a year in July, was it?
No, he only died in July.
In 25?
25, yeah.
I said 24, so it was July 25.
Mm, yeah, just last,
oh,
just
gosh,
gone.
Not
yeah.
even a year.
Yeah. So it's, it was.
You're still in it.
Yeah, I'm still in the, yeah, definitely, for sure.
But I suppose those early days, what was that like for you?
Like, the way that I am with it is I got straight back to work. What I noticed was that your capacity, your creativity, obviously my job is very much revolved around creativity and that as well, which obviously a lot of it is the marketing side of things for the business and that, and videos and social media, and you just have to come on as if everything's good or whatever. And don't get me wrong, like, I have always been fine around everyone. I've still been able to go out. From the outside, I still the exact same, I would imagine, you know what I mean? But where I find it's definitely the hardest is, like, you know, every single day, like, to be honest, you're driving along the car, for example, and you'd have a cry for yourself, like, to be honest with you, you know? But as I said, I'm able to go out and live normally. But as I said, it's like, it's in the silence and the quietness. And it's every day and numerous times a day you just get flashbacks. And what I find is very strange about the whole experience is that you I have such vivid pictures in my head of different moments throughout that 4 weeks. Like, just the clearest of pictures in my head of lying down in the bed with them or having a conversation with them, which is strange. And that could, you would have had dreams as well. That's something I noticed, like, after very vivid sort of dreams. And as I said, just in the silence is definitely the hardest part. But I like thinking about him a lot, you know, and I love talking about him because I know he'd like to be talked about as well, you know, sort of a way.
He'd love this.
But
I saw on your Instagram, which I'm going to mention in a few minutes and have a chat about that, but the man was fond of photos.
He was fond of photos.
What a legend.
He was fond of photos.
Because a lot of men hate photos.
Yeah, yeah. He was just pure out Egypt, like. Do you know what I mean? Yeah.
So you've loads of photos of him.
We do have a lot. Like, him and Mam were able to come out to Australia.
You were in Australia.
Yeah, so I was there for 2 years. So it was the Christmas 24, him and Mam came out for 3 weeks and, yeah, they had the best time ever. Like, and you know something as well about that time where I would have, it was, say, finished, they'd headed home, and there was something about it, and it wasn't just because he's passed now, but I remember thinking, geez, that was actually just a very nice time, you know what I mean? And I'm so grateful that they were able to experience that, because they were meant to come the previous year, and his mother passed, so they weren't even going to come, but thankfully they did, because even the amount of pictures from that trip alone and just seeing the crack that he had, and he loved every bit of it, and obviously Mam as well, like, you know. So that was a brilliant time. But on about the picture side of things, obviously not everyone loves pictures, and that's fair enough, but if there's something that's definitely helped me anyway and helped us, it's having pictures, a lot of them. I think it's been such a huge help, because for me anyway, when the pictures are there, and even better nowadays, there's more videos than that too. They're there in a way as well, you know, you still feel them in a way, you know. I think that's been a huge help to me, to be honest, because you'd be laughing and you could be crying at different ones, and I think that's been definitely a big help for us all. And obviously not everyone loves taking pictures. They mightn't be happy in themselves, mightn't be happy in their body in a way, do you know what I mean? But it's just there's a picture's a lot more than that, like, in my opinion, you know what I mean? And it can be, you can, in the moment, it's very easy to be like, no, but it's like there's more to a picture than just you on a screen, like, you know. That's the way I look at it now anyway, for sure.
Yeah, you're freezing a moment in time.
100%.
It's more than just a photograph.
Without a doubt. So yeah, he got a lot of them over the years.
I want to segue into something there, what you're saying about photos and people not feeling confident to be in them, but just before I do that, I would love to ask you, as you're a young man, and a father is such a significant character in your life, like, what is it like to be a young man, to know you have a long way to go in life without your dad beside you? That's hard.
That's the hardest part, I think, isn't it? Like, because there's no beating around the bush. Like, hopefully there's going to be plenty of milestones in life, you know, as time goes on. You know, there'll be hopefully kids and marriage, hopefully. And yeah, it's just, you know, that he would be such a loud presence in all of them milestones, that when he's not going to be there, it's hard to wrap the head around. And it's not something that I would have ever even thought was going to be possible, because again, you never think that this stuff happens to you. So that's the hardest of it all, I think. As time goes on, you know, you think that, well, I would have thought that there'd be another 30, 40 years with dad, if I'm being honest, you know what I mean? And that's, I haven't even been alive for 30 years yet. And to think that you have to go through, hopefully, another 60 myself, and him not being there for any more of it, is just again, mind-boggling. And I obviously think about that a lot, but there's nothing you can do about it. And that's the long and short of it. And you just have to try and live in a way that he would want you to live and enjoy the different things, I suppose, you know?
Yeah.
So that's definitely the hardest part for sure, yeah.
That's the way the cards fell.
That's it, unfortunately.
What you do, a lot of people will maybe recognize you from online. You have a really, really successful business called Glean. And you're one of those guys that pop up and it's just pure rip in the piss. I love it with your videos. But it's all around, I suppose, health, really. Mm. You know, weight loss, all these words online can be met with a wave of negativity sometimes. I love the way you do it. You spoke so openly yourself about, I suppose, binge eating and having a difficult relationship with food. And, you know, I, in a former life, was a trainer for a good 13 years as well. So I was in that industry. And something that I think, it's not as straightforward as, here, follow this plan and you'll lose weight. There you go. It's, if I always say, everyone knows what to do. You know what to do. I don't need to tell you how to lose weight. If you come to me as a trainer, I don't need to tell you what to do. You know what to do.
Yep.
But we don't do it. And that's the in-between part that people need help with. Why would I be talking about this in a grief podcast? I think that an awful lot of people struggle after the fact. Either people can lose a lot of weight, no appetite. An awful lot of people turn to food for comfort. I know I'm one of them.
Mm-hmm.
If you've a sticky or tricky relationship with food, you can kind of use that as a coping mechanism. Was that ever anything that happened with you? You know, you said that in the past you had dealt with binge eating and things.
Mm.
Is it something you have to be careful with now? Did you find, like, with grief that you were kind of trying to want to swallow it down?
To be honest with you, I wouldn't struggle now with binge eating at all.
Obviously,
however,
yeah,
in the past, it was consuming my head every day, like in regards to the food noise, that constant chatter, wondering what you're going to have next, and the obsession around chocolate, for example, you know, where now I've got my relationship with food in a good place, if I'm being honest, you know, it's not something. However, what I've definitely lost a little bit of weight throughout the process, just because I suppose my stress response would be probably not to eat, where another person's stress response would be to eat, you know what I mean? So you have two different types of people. And yeah, for me, it wasn't something that it's not something I struggle with now, but I'm sure that if this was back 6 years ago, I could be on the total opposite spectrum of that, you know? And I think, like, you know, if someone is going through that, I think what's important to, there's different stages, I think, to all this too, where there's different priorities throughout your grief journey in that. And if someone is maybe using food for a little bit of comfort for a period of time, in my eyes, there's worse things that you could be doing in that. And I think it's important to show yourself a bit of compassion and have a bit of empathy and allow yourself, and that's not to say that you just be okay with constantly, say, turning to food and you don't try and, like, help yourself that little bit, but I think you have to try and just go through the phases of letting yourself heal one thing after another. And I think this is where it's important to try and have different outlets for your stress, well, and positive, healthy habits throughout the grief as best you can, you know, and meet yourself where you're at, you know. Like, for some people, getting up and getting a 10 minute walk is like trying to climb Kropatrick, you know, especially throughout that period of time. And but if you can just try and slowly ease yourselves into these kind of positive habits, and you'll get there eventually. But if you are someone that is kind of finding yourself leaning into food for a little bit of comfort, that's okay. Like, that's okay, because time will do its thing. But as long as you're aware of it and you're just mindful of it, I think, and having that self-awareness around it, that's the first step, number one. And you have to let time do its thing, I think, with the two, you know, because there, you can, it's the least of your worries for a period of time, in my opinion.
You're so right.
Mm.
you know, there's some, you know, and people will say, maybe if you go and get a bit of exercise now, and, you know, again, all good and well telling people to do this, but some people cannot get even out of the bed, you know, and it's all so different. Grief is so unique and so different, and how someone reacts or responds is totally unique. And, you know, some people turn to exercise in an unhealthy way.
Exactly.
Like, you
it's
know?
Punishment in a way. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's, so
it, that's, yeah. I think with that, like too, that it's, people can sometimes almost lose every bit of zap for life that they had, and they lose every almost bit of care for themselves that they might have had as well. Do you know what I mean? And they just some people just don't care about exercising, or don't care about having a quality diet for a certain period of time. Do you know what I mean? And if for some people, if you haven't necessarily been through that, the idea that you can't go out for a walk, it could be mind-boggling to someone. But that the reality of it is, some people are just, it just zaps them so much that it's such a challenge. That's not to say, of course, that just try your very best. Do you know what I mean? Eventually, when you're ready and meet yourself where you're at and gradually build things up. It's not to say remove all power from you, but it's to, I think, show yourself a bit of compassion. Because if you start just beating yourself up about it, things only get worse, and self-sabotaging behavior start coming in even worse again, you know. And that's what I see, to be honest. And that's kind of what we, I think, just having that bit of empathy is one of the key parts to it all when it comes to emotional eating and comfort eating, you know.
I can see why you're a good coach. No, I love that. I love that so much. Mm. Is that straight away you're in going, it's okay, it's all right. And like another coach would say, yeah, you really need to try and cut out the sugar, you need to do this, you need to do that. It's like, no, like, see someone where they're at, you know. And the more pressure you put on someone, the worse it can be sometimes. It can spiral further, because then they're full of guilt and full of shame and full of those emotions that want to keep you trapped, you know. But by giving someone, it's okay, even if you go for 1 minute of a walk, you're bloody winning today. Good on you.
That's all you're trying to do, is just gather the little micro wins. Like, and as you said there, it's the guilt and the shame, because if you tell someone to do something that's outside of where they're at now and they can't do it, it's just, I'm a failure, I'm no good, I should feel guilty for this. And then it's the knock-on effect of that guilt usually leads them to the behaviours of the emotional eating, the self-sabotaging, because they just feel shame within themselves. And I think so many people are so out of touch with the struggles that a person has if they are struggling with their weight or with their relationship with food. It's not the sugar. Like, as in, there's just so much more layers to the, there's so much more shit that matters than telling someone to cut this out or cut that out. There's just, you're so far away from the actual problem, aren't you?
It really, really bothers me when people are like, should just cut out sugar. I'm like, well, just tell an alcoholic to cut out fucking whiskey.
Yeah.
Just swap it for water. No problem.
Yeah.
Like, it's so much deeper. And actually, I love, Gabor Maté was the one who helped me to understand it by saying, it's not why the addiction, it's why the pain. Like, you got to look at, like, why someone, and I talk about it in an addiction sense, because some people are in this addiction and chokehold of, like, sugar or whatever it is. And it's not so simple as, she just, you know, don't buy it.
Yeah.
Like, just leave it at home, don't buy it. But she's like, if people knew that, they would do it.
They would
do
it.
If it was that simple, they would do it.
Exactly.
But you have to look at the why. What's the pain? What's the thing that they don't want to feel that they're suppressing? What's the distraction in their mind? And I'm just mentioning this here because I do know, and I've speak to hundreds of people, and you do too. Mm. And particularly, like, if you've had a trauma or a huge loss, like, people, as you said, just give up on life. They just don't care. I don't care how I look. I don't care if I've gained 6 stone. I just don't care if I die, you know? And it's like, I think people need to see that and witness it and not pretend like it's not happening. And, you know, people, for me to say to people who are listening now, I understand that. I see that. It's okay if you have lost yourself. If you were a person who ran every day, who did the gym, and now you don't do that at all and you sit at home eating, it's okay. We see you. We understand. It's a lot of pain. It's actually life changing. You're not the same person you were before, so it makes sense. But giving yourself compassion, I suppose, would be the advice that, me from that background, you deep in that work would say is giving yourself compassion, first of all, not judging yourself.
Yeah, exactly. Give yourself compassion. And it's, I think some people like miss this. It's like giving yourself compassion doesn't mean that then it's like you're never going to allow yourself to take action on getting yourself maybe out of the places you don't want to be in. That's not what that is. I think just giving yourself compassion is not beating yourself up, acknowledging what you actually have been through, but not shaming yourself, because it's, as we said there, it's the shame and the guilt that is the complete underlying problem to all of these kind of, I suppose, behaviors, and so say negative behaviors as such, you know. And when someone can actually be a little bit sounder to themselves, they'll want to maybe start, maybe get out for that little 10-minute walk, or they might want to start maybe looking at the nutrition that little bit as time goes on. And it can be a gradual thing for some people, but I don't think ever coming at it from the place of guilt and shame ever works, because I think the first area is the compassion, but then it's allowing and trying to help someone know that they also have the power within them to make these little changes, but to do it gradually over time and rack up the small wins. Because what used to feel successful for one person now might just feel like a complete marathon away. You know what I mean? One person might have, as you said there, running, they could be running every day, they might have been running a marathon, they could have been going to the gym multiple times a week. But now that might feel like just, it's so far away. But that's not to say that now getting outside for 20 minutes for a nice daily walk, that doesn't mean that that's not successful, because it's relative to the person. You can adjust and you can build and you can turn the dial on. And the way the analogy that we often use is like, I think with your health and fitness, it's like, it's trying not to look at it as an on-off switch, but rather like a little dimmer switch in a way. You know what I mean? There's periods where you'll be feeling in the groove with your nutrition and with your movement. There's periods in where that your priorities in life are just completely different, but it's just trying as best you can not to turn off that switch in a way and keep dim it that little bit. Keep something going, because it's that allows you to make yourself feel that little bit better. Do you know what I mean? Even when you're not necessarily wanting to do, but getting out for that bit of fresh air, that little bit of a walk. And sometimes it's like building that little bit of momentum for yourself as well in a way, do you know? Mm-hmm. That's not to say that it's easy by any means at all, but it's showing yourself the compassion and trying your very best to make the small little steps when you're ready, do you know?
Yeah, I like that, because like as you're talking, I'm thinking of, let's say before my sister died, I was telling you, I was doing photo shoots, six pack, the whole shebang,
yeah.
Which actually in reflection was, you often hear people talk about, it was so unhealthy,
yeah, yeah,
how I did that. But I think when I got like so exhausted, so tired in my grief, every single day that went past that I might have put one more pound on, I kept going, I need to get back to her. When that her is gone, like, you know, it would have been okay to be where I was at, but I couldn't. I kept saying, and I think, to be fair to me, I was in a job teaching as a personal trainer, so there's a huge amount of pressure to look good and be a role model. And then when you feel yourself slipping and eating crap, you're like, oh my God. And it was a mess and a spiral, downward spiral actually.
Yeah.
Because I kept focusing back on something else, which probably, you know, it wasn't the life I was in anymore, you know. So you're in this different phase of life, and to meet yourself where you're at and to give yourself compassion is the right thing to do. And so the point I was trying to make there as well is like, why does it even matter? Because when you are so low and so broken and so, you know, carrying so much hurt, it's not about like looking better. It's exercise will help you. And so that's why if at some point you can do it, no one's telling you to do it because of how you look. It's because that it can help your mental health. You're already on the decks, you know, and so much people have so much trauma, so much hurt. Mm-hmm. And the only reason that I feel always, the only reason anyone should give a shit about it is when you're eating crap, you know, it becomes a vicious cycle. Everyone's sleep is interrupted, I think, during grief.
No question,
I'd say. And so when you're not sleeping, you're tired the next day. You don't want to eat well. You eat sugar and you eat shit to keep you going, you know, and it's a vicious, and then you can't sleep that night because you're full of sugar, and it's just a spiral.
On, yeah.
And then the weight comes on and comes on and comes on. So to even try and fight back, as you said, and do the what's it right in front of you, even if it's 5 minutes of a walk, mm-hmm. to keep the I think that's brilliant advice, to keep the dim switch something going.
Yeah, because that's the thing where it's not about looking good, really. It's
that's a byproduct.
I think that's it, isn't it? It's literally, it's trying to do the things that you know are going to make yourself feel that little bit better. And it's not to think that you're just going to feel amazing and incredible. That's not the thing. But it's more
it's
just
not going to fix the grief.
Just try and get yourself through the day feeling that little bit better.
Yeah.
Do you know?
Yeah.
And you said something there. I thought that was good. Where you had mentioned that you felt you were at this position where obviously your sister had passed, and you were trying and thinking that you needed to get back to where you are, probably training 6 days a week, probably tracking every morsel of food that you're eating, and you thought that that's what you had to do. But in fact, what would be good enough for you was the small little step before that of a daily walk. You know what I mean? Mm. That would have been good enough for you, but you can't see that. Yeah. And then when someone...
But that's where you go wrong.
Yeah. And when someone thinks a mountain's so high and so far away, they just don't start at all. And they just say, feck, I might as well stay doing what I've been doing.
Yeah. I'm like, either I'm back in the gym training, lifting weights twice a day, or you're not doing it right.
Yeah. And that's the...
It was a big mistake.
Yeah.
In reflection, I'm like, you would have been just fine to get a little bit of activity. But to me, it was like all or nothing.
Yeah. That's it. And that's the mindset, isn't it? That's the flicker switch, yeah.
But yeah, it's a learning curve.
But it's learning, and that's it. Like, it's just, you just have to, you go through it, don't you? People just go through it at different stages and just trying your best, I think. That's, yeah.
So what you do now, obviously, is, as I said, so successful. And I think people, it's not in me to recommend people, but I think you can hear in you the compassion you have. So if someone wants help, they should go check you out. I'll put it all in the notes here. I know you're very busy. You don't necessarily need a drumming up any business, but I just love what you've just said there. The compassion that's in you is the right way to do it. Just kind of before we finish up, did your dad get to see how successful you were? And what did he think of it?
He saw the whole thing, all right? Like, and sure, he was just blown away by it. He was just blown away by everything. Because obviously, as I said, like, obviously, the only thing that I thought I was going to be doing was the racing side of things. And I never thought that I'd get on that well with anything else. But just thankfully, it's just gone good so far. So good. Please God, things stay going. And yeah, he was so invested in it. Like, you know, multiple times a day he'd be ringing. We're over in Australia, you get a call, you forget what time it is in Australia, it could be the middle of the night, you're like, what is wrong with you now? Do you know what I mean? That was the way that he was. But he got to go to, we had one in-person meetup that we did actually up in Dublin, the Radisson Blue Hotel last year, just when he came home. Actually, it was the end of March, and we had say 250 of our members there for a full kind of day and a full event. And he was there, and pictures of him there that day. He was absolutely, he was buzzing. Like, he was buzzing. And I know he was very happy with the way it all worked out. Like, and yeah, hopefully he can help keep things going, I suppose. But no.
Look, thank you so much for coming in to share. I've actually taken a lot of inspiration. I've taken a lot of inspiration from your dad, actually. Like, he just is just everything you want in a parent. Like, just his the way he loved ye and stood by ye and behind ye. And it's just everything. It's goals when it comes to parenting. So thank you for being so open and honest, and I wish you nothing but the best going forward.
Thanks a million, Cathy. And yeah, no, I appreciate you having me on. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Evan.
If this conversation has resonated with you, or if you're navigating grief of your own, I've recently opened a gentle support space called After the Flowers. It's a low-cost monthly membership for people who are grieving, whether that's the loss of a person, a relationship, or a sense of home. It includes group conversations, live Zoom support calls, and sessions focused on supporting the nervous system through grief, like breath work, meditation, and grounding practices. There's no pressure at all. It's simply there if and when it feels right for you. The link is in the bio.